He emerged from the metro at Washington, D.C.'s L'Enfant Plaza station and positioned himself against a wall beside a trash basket. By most measures, he was nondescript, a youngish white man in jeans, long-sleeved t-shirt, and a Washington Nationals baseball cap. From a small case, he removed a violin. Placing the open case at his feet, he shrewdly threw in a few dollars and some spare change as seed money, swiveled it to face pedestrian traffic, and began to play. And then, for the next 45 minutes, the award-winning, critically acclaimed, and internationally renowned violinist Joshua Bell played six classical masterpieces on his $3 million Stradivarius violin. And of the nearly 1,100 commuters who passed through the subway entrance at the height of rush hour that January morning, virtually no one noticed. Exactly seven people stopped to listen to a concert given by a man who regularly fills concert halls at tickets that start at $100 a seat. A few Sundays ago, a homeless man with unkempt mutton chops, grimy, scarred skin, and bad teeth stood outside the front door of a church in suburban Salt Lake City. He held a small sign asking for food, and beside him he had placed a box in which to collect donations. He had dozens of interactions with those arriving for church that morning. Some people helped out. He collected an apple and some crackers and about $20 in cash. Other people, however, made it a point to ask him to leave the premises. The man didn't leave, but instead he entered the church and he came and sat down on the front pew. During the announcements, the man asked if he could share a few words, and to the congregation's surprise, he was granted permission. He came to the pulpit and said he would like to make a contribution to the church that morning, and then asked whether the minister was present. No, he was told the minister was not there that morning, at which point the homeless man removed his glasses and wig and fake beard to reveal that he was the minister of that congregation. When interviewed about his experience, David Musselman, the bishop of the 4th Mormon Ward in Taylorsville, Utah, the minister to that congregation, said, "The majority of people just ignored me and went out of their way not to make eye contact." The reaction to Joshua Bell and David Musselman is one of studied indifference. Many of us have mastered the skill of ignoring people along life's pathway. We've learned to do that because we're busy people, you and I. We're busy as we rush past street performers in a hurry to catch the commuter train so that we can do the responsible thing and show up for work on time. We're good people, you and I, as we avoid eye contact with the panhandler at the intersection, wanting to do the responsible thing of helping out, but without contributing to an addiction to alcohol or drugs. We are religious people, you and I, as we make our way into church, aware, painfully aware of the needs of a broken and hurting world. And so we come to church where we do the responsible thing and pray. Pray for the poor, the hungry, the sick, and the needy. Only like the busy commuters for whom Joshua Bell played and the busy church members whom David Musselman asked for help, we often don't recognize the poor, the hungry, the sick, and the needy who are right in front of us. It isn't because we don't care or don't want to do the right thing. It's simply usually because we often don't recognize what's going on right in front of us. We tend not to see things when they are out of context. We don't see the battered wife or the abused child because they sit next to us in worship and not in a shelter. We don't see the person with depression because they're in the office next to ours, not in the psychiatrist's office. We don't see the alcoholic because she's drinking at the party with us, not stumbling out of a bar. We don't see the pornography addict because he can get his fix online and no longer in a seedy arts theater. We don't see homeless kids who live in the family car or in a shelter or on another family's couch because those kids manage to make it to school and to soccer practice and to choir rehearsal. And for them, life seems perfectly normal. But for the victim of domestic violence, for the sufferer of depression, for the alcoholic, for the addict, and for the person who is simply afraid or alone, hopeless, despairing, life is anything but normal. Life is lived in the cruel wilderness of abuse or the dry land of aching despair or the barren desert of self-medicating a need that neither sex nor drugs can fill. But they and we learn to cope, to negotiate life, to mask our feelings, to disguise our needs. We learn to hide our brokenness. We learn not to speak honestly of who and how we are. Instead, we're fine. Thank you for asking. We don't need anything a little time away won't fix. We look our best and we put one foot in front of the other and we bravely soldier on. Only on the inside, we're broken and hurting and sick. And we wonder if anyone will stop long enough to see who we really are and perhaps stop to help. And so the prophet's word to Israel and to us this morning is a gospel message. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you. And our reaction to that announcement is probably one of mixed emotion. On the one hand, we are very glad indeed that God has come to save us. But must it come with vengeance? I mean, do we really need to involve a violent, vengeful God? Hadn't we got rid of that God with the age of the Enlightenment? Only perhaps it is we who could deal with some enlightening ourselves. As several scholars point out, vengeance in this instance refers not to unfettered violence, but rather to retribution by a legitimate authority. In Isaiah 35, 4 and other similar texts, it has the further emphasis of retribution that brings liberation to the oppressed, freedom from a situation of need, and the restoration of justice. Its meaning is closer than to what you and I call restorative justice than to vengeance. And God's terrible recompense, the phrase might be translated God's response or God's dealing, how God chooses to take care of any particular situation. And so with the prophet, we say to the victim of abuse, the one who suffers depression, the alcoholic, the addict, the one who is broken, the one who is lonely, to those who have learned to mask their own needs, God is here. Restorative justice is on its way. Hope now in God's dealing. Expect God's response, for God will come and save you. and the sign of God's coming is healing. For the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. The lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless will sing for joy. All of which is good news, unless you presently occupy a prison cell, as John did. And there are many kinds of prison cells. Some are the property of the city of Dallas or the state of Texas or the federal government. Some are cells of others' making, expectations we couldn't possibly hope to meet, job expectations we know we'll never fulfill. Some are prisons of our own making, unable as we are to share with others who we truly are and what we dream of being. Prisons of our own aging bodies or failing minds. Prisons of relationships that promise no hope. What good then are those signs of God's promised coming? If I live in a prison or a desert, or wasteland. Are you the one who is to come, we ask with John, or are we to wait for another? And Jesus says to John and to us, look about you and judge for yourselves. For the eyes of the blind have been opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Lame leap for joy. The lepers are cleansed, and the dead are raised. That, my friends, is the music of salvation. God has given us songs for sighing, to announce the good news that our God has come, is risen with healing in his wings. The song of salvation is playing. Are you willing to stop to hear the music?